Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And what if mayors ruled the world? Political theorist Benjamin Barber asked that question in a forthcoming book and a lecture he's giving this afternoon at the CUNY Graduate Center. Basically, he thinks the world would be a better place if mayors ran it. Ben Barber is senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at the CUNY Graduate Center. Hi, Ben. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Great to be with you again.
What made you imagine a world run by mayors?
Well, you said maybe it would be better. It's hard to imagine a world that could be any worse than it is right now. I suppose some people would say almost anyone running it, but the people who are running it would make it better. But my thesis is that if we go back to the place where human civilization started and democracy started and human organizations started, to the city, to the polis, and think about the role cities might play in the modern world, it may turn out that they are capable of cooperating across borders in a way that nation states never really have been for the last 400 years. That in a sense, what we need to do is change the subject. We're talking about the UN, the United Nations, nation states, the President Obama, his agenda. We're not talking very much about cities, and yet it's the cities who are doing the hard lifting in environment, in security, in transportation, in all the important things that impact us every day.
But before we even get to that next level of New York talking to Tokyo, talking to Sao Paulo, whatever it is, talk more about the idea, because you invoke the old adage that there is no liberal or conservative way to pick up the garbage. Is that a way of saying the job of mayor is so practical compared to a member of Congress or a head of state, that mayors tend to be more practical and pander less to political ideologies?
It is indeed. And you see that in many different ways. Mayor Bloomberg's a Democrat, he's a Republican, but in the end, he's an independent. Most mayors end up feeling fairly independent. Ideology does not dictate how you fill potholes, how you plow the streets, how you pick up the garbage, how you keep the subways running, and so on. It doesn't help very much. You've got to solve real problems. The immigration problem, illegal immigrants. It's one thing for the nation to worry about its borders. It's another thing for a mayor to figure out what to do with the kids and the women and the people who are there, whether legally or illegally. So the practicality and pragmatism of being mayor looks very different than the ideological, divisive, polarizing party commitments of national politicians.
And I guess climate change, which is another example that you use. It's one thing to argue in Congress over whether climate change caused by man is real. It's another thing to be the mayor and have to rebuild Queens.
Exactly right. And, you know, anyway, the mayor of New Orleans, the mayor of Florida and Louisiana coast cities, the mayor of New York is trying to figure out whether to string barricades across New York Harbor or put large balloons into the subway and tunnel entrances. And if somebody says, yes, but what is the science of global warming? He says, I haven't really got time for that. I've got to figure out how to keep the water out of the subways.
On the other hand, maybe there is a Democratic and Republican way to pick up the garbage or drive the kids to school. There's a strike in the city right now over whether school bus drivers should have unionized job security. There's a big fight over stop and frisk and paid sick leave, and I could go down the list. Rudy Giuliani was not Rahm Emanuel. So maybe there is a Democratic and Republican way to pick up the garbage.
The fundamental question of the size of government, do we trust in the public or private sectors, are questions that without doubt cross national, state, and local boundaries. And obviously, there is a more government-centered or private company way of picking up the garbage. But what happens at the local level is that the ideology and polarization is drained out. And the question really is, how does it get better done? What's the better way to do it? John Lindsay learned in the 1960s when he plowed Manhattan and didn't plow Queens and Bronx after a big snowstorm. He learned something about being mayor that had nothing to do with being a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican. The ideological things really do drain away when you have to do the real things. Mayor Teddy Kollek, who was a famous mayor in the 80s and 90s of Jerusalem, once said he was being plied by rabbis and imams and some Christian prelates about access to the holy sites in Jerusalem. And he finally said, gentlemen, spare me your sermons and I will pick up your garbage. I will fix your potholes. And I love that. You know, I'll fix your sewers, because that's what he said. It doesn't really matter the things you're talking about. This is what matters. And that's also what matters. And here's the other thing about cities. The United States government, the Russian government, the Chinese government, it's a distant bureaucratic entity, easy to feel alienated from, easy to have a populist-style right-wing party saying they're not your friends. But the neighborhood, the city council, your district councilor, a mayor of a town of 50 or 100,000, 200, 500,000 people is your neighbor. Mayors are homeboys. Your relationship to them is very different. If you look at all the extraordinarily dismal statistics about trusting government, trust in the Supreme Court, trust in the president, trust in the Congress, which are all dipping down into the 20s or below, and then ask trust in mayors, it's still up 60 or 70% because they're ours. They belong to us. That so-called halo effect that protects our homeboys works with a vengeance in cities.
Listeners, what if mayors ruled the world? You want to get in on the conversation? 212-433-WNYC for Benjamin Barber, 212-433-9692. So do you see this? You don't just point out differences between national and municipal governments. You're actually calling for some kind of change in the way political society is organized, right?
I am. And the change I'm calling for is in part a description of a change already underway. I'm calling for mayors to rule the world. That is to say, I'm calling for some kind of a global assembly of cities, a global parliament of mayors in which at least informally decisions are taken, consensus is reached, and cities can opt in and out of it in ways that allow them to cooperate. But some people have said, well, that's just a pipe dream. What, are you crazy? The fact is it's already happening. There are hundreds of intercity organizations, many of them global in scope, who already do this. ICLEI, the Group for Sustainable Local Governments, the C40, a group that Bill Clinton and Mayor Bloomberg and others were involved in setting up, are deeply involved in reaching climate agreement for cities. What people don't realize is that 75 to 80% of global emissions come from cities. That means if mayors take action in those cities, we can have extraordinary impact on global warming, even if states continue to do nothing, even not endorse Kyoto. So there's a lot of opportunity to do things. Cities are already doing it. I'm suggesting we formalize a little bit the informal intercity networks underway and create an actual global parliament of mayors.
Put on your headphones, Ben, so you can hear the callers. And I think Dan in Brooklyn wants to push back against this idea a little bit. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I really think that if you look at the corruption in the United States historically, it starts from the bottom up, and it's most felt by the public at the bottom. And the local police forces are usually utterly undemocratic at the bottom, historically and currently. And it's where you have the least chance to do anything about it. Now, personally, I think if you take Teddy Kollek, a really oddball situation, and make that the basis of your argument, I don't think it really is correct. The fact is, in this country, if you look historically, it's always been corruption fought from the top against the local operations at the bottom.
Dan, I'm gonna leave it there. But he makes an interesting point, and it also makes me harken back to the civil rights era, where the municipal and the state governments in the South wanted to keep enforcing Jim Crow, and it took the federal government to come in and clean them up.
Yeah, interestingly, historically, there is no question that in matters of civil rights in the late 19th and into the 20th century, in matters of controlling monopoly corporations and the Gilded Age, the federal government, particularly the courts, played a crucial role in preventing states and localities, more states, by the way, than municipalities, mm-hmm. but states, from abusing civil rights, from abusing voting rights, and many other things.
And corruption?
I'll come to that one thing at a time. But on the issue of the federal role in protecting us, things have reversed. Things change. I agree with the caller. I grew up in the 1950s and 60s when the federal government was helping young black men and women into colleges and universities and schools in the South with armed federal troops. And that was amazing. And the last thing I'd want is the mayor of Little Rock to be doing. So, I get that. We all know. But times change. Things change. Nowadays, the United States, China, Canada, and other states have 4 years running, going to the Kyoto climate negotiations and come away empty-handed, saying their sovereignty prevents them from monitoring or doing any of the work to even endorse a Kyoto protocol that is no longer relevant to our current global warming. Cities, on the other hand, Mayor Villaraigosa of Los Angeles has cleaned up the ports and deeply impacted congestion there. Mayor Bloomberg in New York has worked hard on changing the ways in which oil is used in city apartment buildings, insulation of buildings, painting buildings at the top white to reflect light, because in New York it's housing that actually, residential and business buildings that actually use up most of the energy. You can impact that, and that is happening. And the state, the federal government, is part of the problem, and cities have become part of the solution. Right. So don't live in the past. Live it where we are now.
So this is at the policy level. But when Dan brings up corruption, which just look around the state of New Jersey, as one example for how many corrupt local officials have been exposed in recent years. This actually doesn't happen as much at the federal level.
Well, it depends. By the way, this is a global book. It's about countries all over the world.
Yes.
And if you look at Afghanistan and you look at Pakistan and you look at a lot of African countries, corruption happens not at the local level, but at the state and the central government level. So corruption is a general problem. So is inequality. So are the inequalities of predatory capitalism. Those are problems across the board. And I have two long chapters that face up to the reality that inequality and corruption are big problems for the city. So I'm not denying that.
Right. China, too, facing down local-level corruption.
Beaujolais, for example, whose trial is about to begin there for his, in Chongqing, the things he did. And my book does deal with all that. So this isn't the book of denial. This isn't the book that says cities are perfect, they'll do it.
Yeah.
But what it does say, and here's the third thing I want to say about corruption, though. Interestingly, and this will provoke listeners, and I don't mind, if you read Catherine Boo's wonderful book on Mumbai and the ghetto of Mumbai, she says over and over again that, in fact, corruption seen by the middle class is a terrible thing in cities. For people entering cities, for the poor, for people living in the underclass, corruption may be the only form of opportunity that exists. And Catherine Boo talks about that at some length. I don't want to endorse corruption. I do want to say corruption is a way of doing things that allows people in the informal economy to have an informal economy and move along and get some upward mobility. So it's not all bad. But it is bad. It is the poor who get hurt by it. It is a city problem, but it's also a federal problem, but the rule of cities and the rule of mayors does not solve every problem. It simply suggests that cities can do a lot of the things that states can't and aren't doing.
Political theorist Benjamin Barber asking, what if mayors ruled the world? You're giving a talk on this afternoon. This is open to the public?
It is open to the public. It's at the Graduate Center of City University between 34th and 35th Street on 5th Avenue, and it's in the auditorium and in the entry level, and the public is welcome. And I'd love to – we're going to have a debate. Well, I'm going to talk for a while, but we'll have a debate about these questions because there are many issues to debate. But the real purpose here is to change the subject, because all of our focus is on Kyoto, states, the problem of states, not on cities. Mayor Bloomberg said recently in a wonderful statement, he said, you know, the NYPD is one of the largest armies in the world. I have my own State Department dealing directly with the UN. I don't go through Foggy Bottom. I do a lot of things on my own. Washington doesn't like it, but I don't much care about what Washington thinks, because New York has to solve these problems. And that's true for an awful lot of mayors. We talk about ecology, but even in national security, the mayor, originally Giuliani, sent right after 9/11, sent a bunch of intel detectives from New York Police Department to Washington to join Homeland Security and try to get some information. After 2 years, they came home. They said, we're getting nothing. The agencies are fighting one another. We're learning nothing. The police commissioner, Kelly, then with Mayor Bloomberg's endorsement, redeployed about a dozen intel detectives to Singapore, to Hong Kong, to Frankfurt. He sent them city to city. One of the reasons I believe New York has been as safe as it has, and knock on wood that it stays that way, is that we now have one of the best intel operations in the world as a result of city to city cooperation. So even in national security, city to city cooperation makes a difference.
Jim in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Benjamin Barber. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks. I spent a lot of time in France, and I noticed that in France, almost every national politician, including prime ministers, cabinet ministers, party leaders, are also at the same time mayors on the local level, sometimes with small little villages. And the idea is that unless you have real responsibility for getting real things done, a politician will get sort of lost and caught up in the claustrophobia of Paris and the capital. And so having local responsibility keeps politicians, you know, keeps them having a sense of realism and real world problems for real people and how to solve them. I wish we could do that here. But unfortunately, it's not a practice that we do.
Jim, thank you.
Well, that's a great comparative point, and it is true they do that. By the way, that's because in France, mayors are not mostly locally elected, but appointed as part of a national party system, so that guys like Chirac will be mayor of Paris, and then they'll become president. The current prime minister, President François Hollande, though from the north, spent 7 years in Toul, France, a small southern town. Interestingly, he became so attached to it that when he was endorsed and then voted into the presidency, he went to Toul and took the oath of presidential office in his adopted city. So even, I think these callers right, even national politicians get a strong sense of localism. Most places, though, they're two separate career tracks. Very interestingly, no major mayor of the United States has ever been president of the United States. You think Bloomberg knows that and probably regrets it. But the fact is, it's very hard to go from mayor to president because the offices are so very different. And as the caller says, in France, you get the experience of local office that you can take to national office. One more example, President Erdogan, who was the first Muslim president of Turkey to really get rid of the old army and the old Kemalists and to introduce a moderate form of Islam. One of the reasons he's been so moderate is before becoming president, he was the mayor of Istanbul, which is a multicultural, multi-religious city, and he brought a lot of the practicality and pragmatism to the president's office in Turkey that he learned, as the caller was suggesting, in Istanbul. Hickenlooper, who was mayor of Denver and a very practical guy, he owned some beer places, is now governor of Colorado and brings some of that same pragmatism and refuses to identify too strongly as a Republican or a Democrat, says, let's just solve Colorado's problems. So there is a lot of this.
One more call. Brian in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Ben Barber. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, mayors already cooperate in associations like the U.S. League of Cities and things like that. Bloomberg has an organization, Mayors Against Handguns. I'm wondering, what have you seen other mayors doing beyond these kind of associations on topical areas? And also, what could the federal government in the United States do to support more of this kind of mayor-to-mayor interaction?
Right, or for that matter, and as we start to run out of time, what more could cities do to realize your model and start to cooperate with each other even across national borders?
Well, thanks for those very good questions, because in fact, cities and mayors are doing a lot of things in a lot of domains. The arts is a very important area, the International Society for Performing Arts. There are many other organizations, intercity organizations, Cultural Capitals Europe, which organize around the arts. Environment I've talked about, national security I've talked about, but similar things happen in transportation, pedestrian zones, bike share programs. One is coming to New York this spring, are now in 3,000 cities around the world. Those are all shared programs that are the result of people working together. There's a new group called City Protocol in Barcelona that shares on the web best practices from cities all over the world. So that's happening. Second part of the question, the feds. The feds can do two things. One is they can get out of the way, because often they interfere with the efforts of cities to do things. But the other things they can do is to stop cities from going broke. The reality is cities pay a lot more into federal taxes in the United States, and this is true right across the world. Cities are producers of wealth, producers of revenue. Often they give more than they get. It's funny, the rural state Tea Party insists that it's not getting its back from the federal government. But the fact is it's getting a lot more than it gives. Cities get a lot less. So a number of cities like Stockton, California, have gone bankrupt as a result of pressures from the state and the national government. We need more support for the autonomy of cities. They don't need welfare. They need to keep a bigger portion of what they put in to do the job they are doing so very well. The feds, the federal government, the national governments throughout the world will prosper if they let their cities lead the way, because cities can do things that states can't.
Benjamin Barber, senior research scholar at the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at the CUNY Graduate Center, asking, what if mayors ruled the world? He'll be giving a talk on that at the CUNY Graduate Center in the first floor theater there at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And the book, still forthcoming?
The book will be out from Yale this summer, and it's in edits. It's finished, and it's being edited right now, and we hope it'll be out by August, September, October.
Thanks for making us think.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll meet the new congressman from the Lower Hudson Valley. Sean Patrick Maloney is a Democrat who unseated a Tea Party Republican, and he's the first openly gay congressman from New York State. Stay with us.